Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hi, I'm Julie.
And welcome to A Good Story is Hard to Find,
where two Catholics look at the one reality beneath books, movies, and all that jazz.
That's right. That's right. And this is episode number 8.
Ooh.
And today we are going to talk about a movie called Stranger Than Fiction.
Yes, this movie is surprising in so many ways, including the fact that I chose it. And didn't, when I was watching it, I realized I didn't remember a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's amazing. You know, this, I was thrilled that you chose it because it's one of my favorite movies of all time, but I never watched it in the light of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how, when you're looking for things, how many things come out at you, you know, it, and I imagine.
Yeah, it's like a textbook lesson because I think. What I remember before is I kind of came away with a general overview of pre-will versus predestination, that versus cooperation with a bigger plan, that sort of thing. And that's what I was thinking of when I chose it, because I was thinking, well, we'll be at the end of Lent, and sure enough, next week's Holy Week, and Easter's coming, so you've got the depths of the Passion, or the heights of it, I guess. Mm-hmm. The resurrection. So I was thinking about all those kind of big issues. And then when I was watching it, I said, oh my word, these themes and so many more here that apply to life.
Yes. Yeah. And what I thought of when you selected it, I thought, okay, sacrifice.
Oh yeah.
The sacrifice is going to be the main issue, which is a main, it is an important issue in the movie, but yeah, there's so many other things and really surprising things.
And things that were obviously orchestrated, the screenwriter wanted those things in there. But first, let me just, I guess, briefly say what the movie is.
Oh, okay. First, though, I have a question.
Go ahead.
On a scale of 1 to 10, what would you consider the likelihood of you being assassinated?
Being assassinated?
One being very unlikely, 10 being expecting it around every corner. And are you
zero.
In a comedy or a tragedy? Right.
That's good.
That's a line from the movie.
Yes.
But anyway,
I
go
know,
ahead.
That's, and now I know how Will Ferrell, Harold Crick, felt when he was saying,
you bet. Hey,
can you do magic? Can you?
That was a great scene. But yeah, we'll get to that scene. So yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Well, no, I was just going to say it's interesting because it's a Will Ferrell movie, I think would be what you would say, but it's not typical.
Yeah,
for
sure.
He tend to do movies that I don't really appreciate that sort of humor very much, that very broad humor.
Mm-hmm.
More what I would call, not exactly Three Stooges humor, but more in that camp than other.
Yeah, and I would say so too. And this is the best movie I've seen him in. Without question.
Yeah, and this is one of those serious movies that, and I love him in this movie. So I was pleased to see him acting in something that I cared to see. Basically, the idea of the movie is odd but simple. He's brushing his teeth one day, and he suddenly hears somebody, a woman's voice, narrating everything he does.
Mm-hmm.
He can't figure out where the voice is coming from. He can't make it stop. It knows things about him that he never told anyone, and some things I think that he maybe didn't even realize he was doing, like counting how many times he brushes his teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I loved how the filmmakers kind of, this is kind of a unique way to show his character, is there was during the time while he's brushing his teeth and the movie up to that point, which is the very beginning, you're seeing all these computer graphics on the screen that show that he's counting things all the time. He's, you know, he's like a obsessive counter of things, and he brushes his teeth this many times up and this many times sideways. And it's showing it all on the screen in these little,
motion graphics is what it's called in the biz.
Right. Motion graphics. Yeah.
Rose was saying that, this is a classic one in the motion graphics class she had to take at school.
Oh, really?
That's
cool.
She's studying film editing, or that's what she's majoring in. But
Well, it was extremely effective, you know. few words or few movements by the actor, you know so much more about him very quickly because of that stuff.
Yeah. Well, and it's used so effectively because they do it throughout the movie so that you have these little graphics that aren't obtrusive. If you want to ignore them, you can. But they do add another dimension of information communication.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated by it. It's a way above the level that if you saw Moon, where it's done in the credits amazingly, or Zombieland, where it's used repeatedly to give those rules that he follows.
Right, right.
And those are clever. Mm-hmm. But this is actually taking it to a new level where you're information is being reinforced and new information communicated.
Yeah, and it's very clear in the way they did the graphics that it's part of Harold Crick.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
he's
because
it's structured.
Yeah, it seems to be always from his perspective, as if he's looking at a computer screen sometimes that's facing him. Even though the camera's pointed at Harold, the computer screen will be backwards so that you can, it's almost as if he's got this thing in front of him all the time that he's calculating and calculating.
Or an analysis of him or something like that. I don't know.
Right.
That's a good point. I hadn't noticed that. But essentially what happens is, so you follow Harold through part of his day as this voice narrates. And it's very interesting narration. I mean, you're listening going, wow, what a beautiful way to say that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he is an IRS agent, and he's probably the most boring person ever. I mean, his apartment doesn't have any pictures on the walls. I noticed that. It's like he doesn't live there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not decorated at all. It's very beige, and that represents his whole life, I think. It's unfinished. It hasn't been enriched.
Yeah, he's kind of in a holding pattern.
Yeah.
For something. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so he's, you know, working in a place with cubicles. Everybody knows him, though, which is interesting. But when he goes by, they'll call out mathematical problems to him. He can answer them off the top of his head. So he's very focused on one thing. And as the voice is going along, it suddenly says, and I don't think this is a spoiler or anything, says that, you know, he's going to die. And he, at that point, goes, what? Hello? And that's when he realizes he's not really going crazy. There's something else going on. So he starts trying to find help.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And at that point, and I think this was all revealed in trailers and things like this, wasn't it? That it's revealed that the voice is actually an author writing a book.
Right. Yep.
So then you start to see her. And what's very interesting about her, to me, is she's struggling for a way to finish her book. So you see her, and in fact, Emma Thompson plays this person, and she didn't wear any makeup for the role. So she's very washed out looking, very strained looking. She's struggling. You can see she's got writer's block. And Queen Latifah, who's, I can't remember her name, Escher.
Yeah, Penny, I think. Penny Escher.
Penny.
Yeah.
Yeah, Penny Escher is sent by the publisher to help move her along. And she recites this long list of all the things she's done to help authors along. And so, of course, the author resents her highly. So you basically have these two people, and you go back and forth. One is trying to figure out why he's hearing a voice and trying to get help. And the other person is trying to figure out how to solve her creative problem.
Right. Yep.
And that doesn't sound like much of a place to go from, except for the fact that both of them, one is trying to figure out life because Harold wants to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is trying to figure out death because you find out at the very beginning, she kills her characters in every book.
Right, right. And yeah, her main creative problem is that she can't figure out how to
kill him,
kill this character. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, she of course doesn't realize that it's a real person.
And that, to me, was the most interesting thing because what happens is Harold winds up, you know, he tries a psychologist or a psychiatrist. He's like, I believe you're insane. Drugs are the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, really, that's not it. And he finds a literary professor.
Yeah.
Who
Dr. Jules Hilbert.
Yes. It's brilliantly played by Dustin Hoffman. It's probably a role that could was written for his, the kind of character he plays well, kind of detached but interested in things.
And tying into those graphics, one of my favorite scenes with those two is almost the first one in which they meet. Dustin Hoffman as Jules Hilbert, he goes into the bathroom and he immediately picks up that Harold Crick is this obsessive person.
That he counts things.
And what's funny is that Harold is counting all kinds of things, you know, measuring the how much soap is in the thing, you know, all in the back, you know, nothing obvious, but this is all done through those graphics. And then when Dustin Hoffman and he walk out of the bathroom, Dustin Hoffman asks him, did he count the tiles in the bathroom? And that's like the one thing that he did not do. So he says, no, I didn't count the tiles,
you know,
but he counted everything else. Yeah,
I did not even catch that. But if, this is the second time I've seen the movie, and I think the first time might have been a year ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of taking it all in again because I didn't remember a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised at how much I didn't remember. And so, but he'd say things to him, you're right, like, how many stairs did we go up? Or, you know, he knew he was counting all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
He caught on to his character immediately, you know, being a literature professor and having seen people like him. But then he says, you know, you're the least literary person that he's seen, you know, and there's nothing literary about you, I think is what he said.
Yeah. And
to Harold Crick.
Well, and the kind of interesting thing to me is he immediately sets Harold the task of start keeping track of these things that you're hearing or things that you're noticing about your life. Is there a, you know, to see if you're in a tragedy or a comedy.
Because
he says something, he says a phrase, and it's not really even important, I think, at this point to talk about that. But
I think it was little did he know.
Yeah.
Little did he know.
Little did he know that this one.
So Harold was reciting a sentence that was in his
head. What was narrated.
Yeah.
And
he said, little did he know, little did he know.
I taught a whole class on little did he know. That means something you don't know. You are in a novel. And he suddenly calls him back in and says, oh, okay, let's start looking at it. And he is really theoretical about it. He doesn't really care about Harold except as a problem to solve.
Right.
Which becomes more clear as you go along. But Harold is willing to go along because he needs some help and is the first person who took him seriously. And the thing I find interesting is that the professor is so theoretical that he's perfectly able to accept the concept that there is a real author out there writing a book about this real person's life in front of him, and that Harold's hearing it narrated, but really if it was a novel, he wouldn't be real. I mean, there's a strange dichotomy to that that just, or if that's the right word, that just doesn't work. And then, but the professor is so theoretical, he can just ignore all that.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody kind of ignores it, actually.
Yeah, they do.
Except for the author.
That's part of the charm of the movie, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I just found it kind of interesting that everybody's willing to suspend belief in order to go, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the essence of the movie. And I was fascinated by how many things about how we live and the choices we make and the quality of our life and everything else are examined in this really charming little comedy.
Right. Yep. And it is a comedy. Yeah.
Yeah.
We did say that it's serious, but there are extremely comic moments in here, but they're just not Will Ferrell's typical comic moments.
Yes. It's, it's a little higher level.
Yeah. Yes. Higher level comedy. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And
so are we afraid of spoilers today?
Because shall we just say?
I think this is the point right here. Yeah.
Yeah,
let's just say. Yeah, we're going to go farther now. So if you haven't seen this movie, I beg you to go see it because it's a 5-star movie. This is one for the pool room.
So yes, I think.
Yeah, for certain.
I'm going to have to get it for my pool room.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And it was already in my pool room, so that's why I was so excited.
Oh, you have such
good taste. Like I said, I didn't watch it in this light. And, you know, as I'm watching it and seeing all these things, I'm, you know, it occurs to me, you know, here we are in Lent and, you know, what about, you know, our daily lives? What do we miss in our daily lives all the time? You know, I've watched this movie a few times before I watched it again for this podcast. And yet when I watch it in this light, all this stuff comes out. And, you know, how much do I missing in my daily life because I'm not looking for it? That's something that occurred to me while I was watching the movie because it was a different experience, you know?
Yeah, and, how to keep your eyes open for all those chances that you're missing.
Exactly, exactly. Keep listening all the time. It's hard. Well, it's hard to do. You know, you and I talked earlier this week about, you know, I'm reaching a busy point again where, you know, even in prayer, yes, I can't seem to pay attention. And one of the ways that I solve that is I write a to-do list. And if I write a to-do list and trust that I'll go to the to-do list for to-do items, as long as I trust that I'll actually do that, I can let go of that, those items. And then when I pray, I can pay attention. But, you know, I get that way, you know, cyclically, you know. I go through, you know, troughs and hills and stuff. And anyway.
The hard thing, though, is I think it's partly Harold's dilemma is that, for me, the paying attention in prayer kind of means letting go and taking it all in. I mean, and it's not that I don't say things like, okay, you know, so-and-so's having this problem or such-and-so, and, you know, I'm, you know, please help them out. They've asked for prayers, or, you know, I'm kind of worried about this, and so I'm kind of going to trust that you're taking care of it and everything. But the bigger question on prayer for me is the connecting with God to become a better, this sounds weird, maybe a better friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to be able to recognize a friend, you have to know them pretty well. So how do I connect with God other than outside of my own head? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I kind of have to go, okay, keep me in the center of your will.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to notice? What am I? And but you have to try not to notice it, because then you're projecting. I mean, it's
right.
A delicate balancing act. If that, does that make sense?
No, it does make perfect sense. And in this movie, if we connect it to this movie, Harold Crick's character changed, or not his character, but his actions changed the moment where it said he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Then he became an active participant in his own life right from then on. Before then, he was just floating along, you know, not really paying attention to anything, just doing the same thing over and over, counting things or whatever. But from that moment on, things changed. And we didn't talk about, was her name Amy? I know her last name was Pascal. Amy Pascal?
Amy
Pascal. Yeah. She's,
we know the last names of everyone, by the way, because they're all named after famous mathematicians, scientists. Are there? I don't know if there are any artists in there, but there are a lot of art references.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And one thing because what happened is we'll get back to Anna in just one second. But what happened was our whole family got caught up in this because Hannah's living at home right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, y'all, I'm watching this for the podcast. And Hannah instantly started saying things like, look how interesting, everything's centered around public transportation. You can take any bus you want, but they all go to one destination. You can get on or off the bus. You make the choice what you're going to do. But if you get on that bus, it's taking you somewhere. And I was like, wow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's what they meant, but that's an interesting observation in general about life, right?
Yes, yes.
And so then Tom went and started looking stuff up. And one of the things they were saying about those graphics, and we're talking about math and art, this is from IMDb. It says, in an early scene, on-screen graphics appear that resemble an image used to illustrate the golden ratio. In mathematics and the arts, two quantities are in the golden ratio if the ratio between the sum of these quantities and the larger is the same as the ratio between the larger and the smaller. This ratio can be expressed as a mathematical constant, usually denoted by the Greek letter pi. Hmm. And the thing that got me is that connection between art and science is constantly shown in here, because Anna Pascal is a baker, which is very artistic, the way she does it. Yeah. She's got tattoos all over.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, to me, this film also is about the fact that you can't separate things. It's like those people who always go, oh, well, I can't believe in God because it's not provable, or, you know, or the earth is flat because the Bible said so. I mean, you know, you can't just take one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Life is a rich mixture. So I'm sorry I hijacked you.
No, please. That's fine. Anna Pascal. Yeah, we were just saying that Anna Pascal is someone who Harold has to audit, you know, because Harold's an IRS agent. So he goes to her, and then he, you know, it's part of his waking up. He sees her in a different light and becomes attracted to her, and, Yeah, and some hilarious stuff. His wooing of her is really pretty darn funny.
Yes.
But she finds him, you know, endearing. So that's pretty cool.
After a long time, she's struggling with herself.
Exactly, exactly.
I think that's interesting. Everybody in this movie is struggling with themselves, except for the professor, who at the end, he also changes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he finally stops being a lifeguard and jumps in the water to swim. He participates instead of just thinking theoretically.
Yeah.
And the only one who doesn't do that is Penny Escher.
Well, she does. She does too. Because it was just a sentence, you know. And I just happened to catch this. I'm not sure why, but Penny Escher at the beginning, when you first meet her, she tells the author, "I have never asked for more time from a publisher." And then at the very end,
she
asks the publisher for more time because they need to change the book.
But it's because the author needs it.
Right. But I think that that's her activity. That's what she could do rather than never, ever do that. I think that she's engaging at that point because we don't see her do that. But I think that it's a change in her behavior.
Well, see, that's interesting because I saw her a different way altogether. What I saw was everybody experienced an internal change.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see that as an internal change because for me, if you look at this, everybody's struggling with their lives, or they think they understand everything like the professor, and at the very end, they're forced to, somebody won't go along with them, who they admire, and so they have to change, you know, him jumping in the water was, I'm going to participate more fully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I see that's kind of what you're saying about her, but she's disappeared by then. I saw her, actually, I saw the publisher as God.
Huh,
eventually, the publisher's going to get something done. I saw her as the guardian angel. She's providing all these things to try to help, but she herself, she says, I can't do this. You have to do it. I'm just here to assist.
Interesting.
And so when she goes back and asks for more time, that's just what the author needs. She's facilitating what the author needs in order to fully live her change.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, yes. So... because at first I was thinking, how can the author, because you see the author as God, because that's why I was thinking of it as free will and predestination.
Mm-hmm.
She's dictating everything. She knows everything about Harold. And so, of course, huge spoiler, when she says he's going to die, she's determined to kill him off. You see her imagining way after way of death. But she's not omniscient because Harold tracks her down and he meets her. And that's probably one of the funniest scenes when when she's figuring out she's got to answer the phone. Mm-hmm. She's typing. The phone rang and then it rings.
And it rings.
And he's trying to call her. The phone rang again and it rings again. The phone rings a third time and she's afraid to hit the period. And the second she does, the phone rings. And then he's like, hello, this is Harold Crick. And she just about has a heart attack right there. Because she doesn't know what's going on, but she knows it's not right. But because she changes... and it's something she didn't expect. She can't be God.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, and I think I was caught up with the idea of her being the God metaphor because of what she was doing. But it's really interesting that the publisher is because, you know, I can completely see that. And what do you make of the fact that once Harold actually meets Kay Eiffel, that he says, okay, you're not going to kill me now, right? Because you've met me.
I know.
You know, and if there is kind of a God parallel there, that's an interesting thought. You know, I'm trying to formulate a thought here. There's something there, but I'm not sure exactly what.
Well, the thing that got us was, he goes, you haven't written it yet. She goes, not really. And he goes, what? You've written it? And she goes, well, just on note paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an outline.
Right.
And he goes, what? She goes, I don't think it's right. It's final until it's typed.
Yeah, I haven't typed it.
Wait. And so the thing that we were kind of thinking as we were talking about it was that she is another person living her life. And, you know, you make these plans.
Mm-hmm.
You think you're going to do something or you think you understand something fully and you've kind of got it all worked out in your mind. And then you change your mind.
Yeah.
You decide there's another way. You haven't typed it yet. You haven't lived it. It's not final.
Right.
That's kind of how we felt about it, because that's why when she said she had to go back, because she, you know, again, giant spoiler, because he doesn't die, although he doesn't know that because she changes her mind at the last minute for very great reasons, which we'll have to talk about. But that's why Penny says, well, I'm going to, you know, she's going to go back and ask for more time, because she's realized she made a grievous error, but she can fix it. She can rewrite her book. She can fix the parts, because when she's talking to Dustin Hoffman, who shows his complete theoretical interest and his lack of real empathy at that point, which is not necessarily a bad thing. He's right, because he says, well, I've read the book. It's great. It's a masterpiece. You have to die.
Yeah, you have to die.
It's no good unless you die. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm.
So he's saying, yeah, for this work of art, that is important enough that this be right. You know, that I'm perfectly okay with your dying for
it. Right, to sacrifice your life.
Exactly.
And everyone's going, but it's my life. And he goes, but this will live on and influence people forever. You know, he's basically saying you're less important than this theory.
Right.
This beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And he's mad at the author because she changes it. And he's like, well, it's fine. Because she shows him the new ending. Mm-hmm. Because it's all right. It's not what it was. He wanted her to kill Harold because the final piece of art would have been beautiful.
Right.
And she says, she's, you know, because she's very troubled by the people she killed in the books. And she's troubled by the fact that Harold will die and he's real. And so she looks at it and says, if a book is about a man who has to do it anyway and does it willingly, or who has to die anyway and does it willingly, isn't that the sort of man you want to keep alive? She's looking at the big picture and the humanity, what's involved in that person's life. And because she says everybody ever killed was a great person, you know, and she can't do it just for the art of it. She's very human. Mm-hmm. And the professor, that's why I liked the fact at the end that what she'd said may have made sense to him, because he jumps in the pool.
Yeah.
You never see him getting wet. You never see him doing anything. He analyzes stuff like crazy.
Right.
Yep. And I think he said he taught a course in theoretical literature or something. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
And he has that list of 23 questions that he asks.
Yeah, that was interesting too.
Because he's analyzing the literature and.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I enjoyed in this show too, I'm not sure if it was a director's choice or the writer's choice, but the way that they showed the bus driver and the kid with the bicycle, and they just showed him every now and then. I love that, the feeling of connection that they created with that.
Mm-hmm.
In just so tiny bits of space. They just show a kid riding a bike and then this bus driver, you know, getting the job, you know, just every now and then they show a little scene and, you know, she finally got the job and then she's driving the bus and then all of their lives meet, you know, at one point. I mean, that's fascinating stuff.
Yeah. You don't even realize who she is. I didn't realize she was the bus driver until the bus hits Harold. So
yeah, exactly.
Maybe I should have, but
no, I don't think so. I don't think that was the purpose. It was more like you've got people from all over and we're all connected, you know, that's what I got out of that.
Definitely. Yeah. It's that web of connection. And I think that, this writer is very interesting, because since Rose is, as you know, if you're interested in film, don't you want to either direct or write, except as her mother, I try to take that part out of it, but she does have good ideas and she likes to write. So she's working on screenplays and things, of course, because that's what you do if you like to write and you're interested in film. But because of that, Tom, my husband, has taken an interest in who writes things.
Yeah.
Because not very many screenwriters are well known. And
he
looked this guy up and he'd written a lot of plays. And he did one movie before this and it also had Dustin Hoffman. It was somebody's fabulous.
Oh, the Magic Emporium or something.
That's it. So right. Mr. Magruder's Magic Emporium or something, which I've never really seen or heard of much. But he did this and now I don't think he's doing any movies. So he brought a whole new way of looking at things, I think. And he said he wouldn't show screenplays to anybody. And this interview that we found was while this was being written.
Oh, neat.
It's an old one. And he said he wouldn't show his screenplays as a outline to anybody. He said, because you go back 12 weeks later, well, you've been working on it and developing it as a screenplay. At the same time, the people you gave the outline to at the movie executives have been kind of formulating their own idea of what it means. So by the time that you two meet again, you're bound to disappoint them.
Right.
And they're bound to not like what you did. And thinking about that in terms of this movie, can't you imagine how difficult that would have been to get across these concepts? And it was based on a book, and this was the point I was taking a long way to get to. Where is that? It's based on a book by a Spanish author. It says, the film borrows heavily from Niebla by Miguel de Unamuno, a Spanish novel about a character who becomes aware he is being narrated by a writer and goes to visit him. However, in Unamuno's story, the main character commits suicide. And in the interview, the journalist made the assumption and said, well, you were brought in to make this more cheerful and acceptable to regular audiences, right? And the author said, oh, no. This ending is the ending I think it should have had. I wanted this to be exactly the way it is.
Yeah.
Which brings me back to the fact that he cares about the little things, because all these little things, it's the last narration of the whole thing that brings it all together.
Yeah.
When they're talking about it's the little things that matter in your life, you know, the loved one's hand, a loving embrace, a cup of coffee, a Danish, secrets, Fender Stratocasters.
Yeah.
And then he says, can I read this? Is that all right?
Oh, yeah. Go right ahead, please.
And she says, excuse me. Because it was the fact that when this was happening, he said, and we can thank God for this. And I went, the first time I heard it, I was like, what? You don't usually hear that in a movie. It says, sometimes when we lose ourselves in fear and to despair, in routine and constancy, in hopelessness and to tragedy, we can thank God for Bavarian sugar cookies. And fortunately, when there aren't any cookies, we can still find reassurance in a familiar hand on our skin, or a kind and loving gesture, or a subtle encouragement, or a loving embrace, or an offer of comfort, not to mention hospital gurneys and nose plugs and uneaten Danish, soft-spoken secrets and Fender Stratocasters, and maybe the occasional piece of fiction. And we must remember that all these things, the nuances, the anomalies, the subtleties, which we assume only accessorize our days, are effective for a much larger and nobler cause. They are here to save our lives. I know the idea seems strange, but I also know that it just so happens to be true. And so it was, a wristwatch saved Harold Crick. And that's how Christians live. It's, everything goes together to make up the big picture.
I'm with you there. That it just blew me away. I mean, that moment, the moment when you watch Harold Crick go ahead and do what he's, you know, he sacrifices himself. Because he reads the entire book. And so it's not for the sake of the art.
No.
Although I guess maybe in a way it is, because, well, gosh, I don't know.
No,
I mean, he's doing it to save it to save the little boy. But the book, which would be about that, would have been a powerful book. You know, so I can understand what Dustin Hoffman is saying too, but you know, I still don't know that I could sacrifice for that.
I think, well, and I think Harold appreciates that, but he does say, he does know that everything she's narrated happens. So therefore he knows that for some reason she's got this, it will happen.
Yeah.
You know?
So
I think he feels that if he's there, that 2 or 3 minutes early, that it's, and he knows that his watch is early and he knows all these things. So he feels like he can turn away from it. And that's where it becomes. So I meant to look up Magritte's painting, Son of Man, but the fact that it's called Son of Man, it's the one with the apple in front of the guy's face.
Oh yeah.
And there's green apples everywhere when he's sitting in the the HR person at work's office, there's the cloud background that's behind that painting is behind him.
Yes, yeah.
It starts moving. So that author, the fact that we found that interview, we suddenly went, okay, all these things could have been just because the guy liked it, although that would have been unlikely. But he meant this to mean something. And when you say son of man, and this guy's deliberately sacrificing himself to save an innocent person, the professor's reading, I is for innocent, at the pool. I mean, it's...
I didn't catch that. Yeah, I noticed that he was reading a Sue Grafton novel, yeah, but well, I didn't I see the title.
Because,
yeah,
I liked that because he's so heavy duty into big fiction, and yes, then he's reading this Pop
and
Whaler.
And I remember that the book had plastic all over it, so he wouldn't get it wet. I mean, it was a treasure.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, I think there's a deliberate parallel there being made. And then, and unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, because we were looking these things up, because we were so fascinated, the author also in one of these interviews made the point that he goes, well, you don't kill Harold. And he goes, well, Harold knows he's going to die, so we can't kill him. That's the surprise for Harold. He goes, but the wristwatch is also a character.
Yes.
The wristwatch doesn't know it will die, and so it must die. But in doing so, it saves Harold's life.
Right.
And I was telling my husband that, and he went, well, you know, at some point you really can overthink it. I'm like, yes. But I love the fact that the wristwatch has been influential in getting Harold there to save that little boy's life, and it becomes part of him forever.
Yeah.
It keeps him alive.
And that's fascinating, kind of a metaphor for Christianity as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a part of who he is.
Mm-hmm.
He carries that piece of the cross, if you will, with him always.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, and as long as we're talking about the screenwriter, you mentioned that everybody's names have to do with, you know, scientists and mathematicians and things.
Yeah.
There are, you know, it is definitely deliberate. He just didn't select these out of a barrel or whatever. Like you said, one of the things that you pointed out was that that question I asked on a scale of 1 to 10, what would you consider the likelihood that you might be assassinated? That no. That was the Dustin Hoffman character, Dr. Hilbert, asking Harold one of 23 questions. Which the mathematician Hilbert had this thing called Hilbert's problems, which was 23. It was a list of 23 unsolvable at the time problems. So Hilbert, I think, if I look this up real quick, was he German? Yeah, he was a German mathematician, right around 1900 or so.
Yeah, some of them are still unsolved? Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yep. I don't. Yeah, there's so. Oh. Yeah, Hilbert originally included 24 problems on the list, but decided against including one of them in the published list. And that's just on Wikipedia. But it's interesting to look at that. But the one that leaped out at me was Anna Pascal, who is, you know, Pascal was a Christian philosopher as well as a mathematician. But he did the thing called Pascal's Wager, which is... him basically saying that, you know, he was, how do I put this? I've got this quote here from Peter Kreft, who's just summarizing it, but it says, if God does not exist, it does not matter how you wager, for there is nothing to win after death and nothing to lose after death. But if God does exist, your only chance of winning eternal happiness is to believe, and your only chance of losing it is to refuse to believe. As Pascal says, I should be much more afraid of being mistaken and then finding out that Christianity is true than of being mistaken and believing it to be true. So if you if you believe too much, you neither win nor lose eternal happiness. But if you believe too little, you risk losing everything. And trying to connect that to Anna Pascal's character is kind of an interesting exercise because she's so... You know, he asks her if she's a member of an anarchist group. And she says, well, wouldn't that defeat the purpose?
Yeah.
I loved her character in this thing.
Yeah, but she's very angry.
She is. She's really upset.
I love that
because,
her shop
is the whole reason
Uprising.
That she's being the whole reason that she's being audited is that she actually figured out that she didn't want to pay 22% of her taxes because that's what she figured went to these things that she doesn't approve of. So she pays 78%, leaves off 22%, and then writes a letter and puts it in with her tax return.
Right.
Fascinating stuff. Yeah. It was really great. And then she changes as time goes on, too.
Right.
Yeah.
His influence changes her. And yeah, because she's so angry and she thinks she has it figured out, but she's kind of, she's won over by Harold. But it's because the thing I loved is the exchange with the professor where the professor, or Harold says, "This isn't philosophy, this is my life." And the professor says, "Absolutely. So go make it the one you've always wanted."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, and at that point I was like, oh, how do you be yourself? And it doesn't mean do anything you want, but Harold had such a drab, empty life because he was so focused. He always wanted to play the guitar.
Yeah.
So he went out and got a guitar and started trying to learn how to play it. I mean, these are the things that they don't mean anything, but sometimes we're so afraid of those little things, we just won't take that step. And why?
Yeah, and why not? Why not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, why not is the question, yes.
Yeah, and then that may be where the wager comes in,
Yeah, the wager is that you're supposed to live for a year as if God exists and see what happens either within you or around you.
Mm-hmm.
And not that you have to pray or anything, but just going, well, what if God was there? And, and because keeping that in mind kind of changes things. And it's interesting. That's so close. I discovered that wager after I converted, or after I found God, so to speak, after I would let him say hello to me. But it's very similar to the wager that I made with him.
Mm-hmm.
Have I told you about that?
Yeah, I've read about it, but yeah, feel okay. free to talk about
Have
it.
Have I talked about that here?
Not here, no. You sure haven't.
Yeah, it was really simple. After we, for reasons I won't go into because it takes too long, we're going to church every week. Basically, our daughter was in a Catholic school, and the teacher was like, "Who's not going to Mass?" And Hannah just the other day said, "I was shocked at all the kids who went, and I was just like, me and one other person weren't." So she made us go, because you'll do things for your kindergartner. And then, so finally I started going, well, I wonder if God's there, because I always wondered. And so I said, okay, here's the deal. I need a new house. Prove to me you're there. This is our bet. You get me a new house, I'll believe in you.
Mm.
And it was, funnily enough, it was about a year later that I don't think I really started believing in God. And I really didn't even think about that bet very much. Just every so often it would surface. And I finally just went, you know what? I actually don't have a reason not to believe in you. No one's proven to me you don't exist. I'm just going to take it on faith. And then that very next day was suddenly, within 2 weeks, we had a contract for a new house. I mean, things happened that were amazing and just rolled out in ways that people were coming to me and telling me, I've never seen anything go this smoothly. And I'd forgotten all about, believe it or not, I was like, you don't have to pay. That's fine. So I put it out of my mind, and about a week into it, I went, you know what? So it was odd.
Yeah. Interesting.
And I don't recommend that for everyone, because that was just the way I did it. But it's kind of like Pascal's wager. You have to at least be open to the concept.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. And
if you're not sure.
I was a little different. I grew up Catholic. When I was 13, I rebelled a little bit. I wasn't a bad kid or anything like that, but I was like, I don't believe in this. And I was allowed not to continue to go because
that's good.
Yeah, because I wasn't trying to be a jerk or anything. I was just like, I really don't believe this, but it stayed with me all the time. And I've always, I kind of went through the Joseph Campbell, everything's true thing. And and then started looking at, Buddhism. It was always in my mind, and I looked at kind of everything and all these arguments and stuff. And then I had some things happen in my life that really felt directed, undeniably directed, where it's just like, isn't this amazing? Yeah, it really is kind of amazing. And then it just took the next step from there, where you're saying, okay, rather than float around like I am, I need to do something. And for me, it was more of a need to give thanks. And then
that's beautiful.
Yeah. And then I
love that.
Oh, thanks. But then I just stepped into it from there. And that's pretty much it for me, how I came back anyway, but it was always a part of me, but I hadn't been confirmed. So I got confirmed. It must've been about, 12 or 13 years ago, I went through confirmation. I'm 43 right now. So
Okay.
About 30 years old is when I came back, so.
Well, so, yeah, because I entered the church later due to other things, directed, very directed, and so this little Easter will be my 11th birthday as a Catholic. So
well, that's
we're
great.
Not
well,
that
it's, yeah,
far
not that far apart
from each other.
How about that? How about
just
that?
Just different roots. Well, and it's the funny thing, and maybe we said this before, but I'm not sure we can say it enough, is a lot of times you look from outside at, you know, like you'll say, these things were very directed, or I'll go, then these things happen over the next 2 weeks. And I've been on the other side. I get it. You look at, somebody else looks at it and says, well, that's coincidence. You're putting a connection there that isn't there. But it's kind of like the person who it's meant for understands. It's like getting a love letter from, you know, your honey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who, you know, they'll say things that don't mean anything to anyone, but those are the little things that mean a lot to you. And
yeah, that's a great way to put that. Yeah,
it's an amazing thing. And I think that's why in this movie, all these people are experiencing something like that, that means something to them.
Yeah.
On a larger or smaller level. I mean, and I think that's why for me, the Penny Escher was not, you didn't see her experience that. Yeah. She went back and said, I'll ask for more time. But I just think that wasn't showing an internal change. I mean, yeah, she was proud of not having to do it, but she did get the book moved along to where it needed
to be. Well, she did. Yeah, she did. And and looking at her as an angel is really, that really fits well.
Because she kept going, I can't help you. I'm here. We're doing it. But, and she'd say, well, did you try this and this and this and this? All the things that worked for other people. And she's like, you don't understand anything about being a writer. And she wouldn't say, yes, I do, because she's not a writer.
Right. No. And, going back to the names of people, the name of the writer is Eiffel.
Yes.
Was it Kay Eiffel, I think?
Yeah, Karen.
Karen Eiffel?
I wrote it down.
Okay, it says Kay Eiffel. So but Eiffel was a structural engineer, you know, responsible for the tower, the famous Eiffel Tower and stuff. And,
the Eiffel Tower is a beautiful piece of art.
Right. And she's locked into the fact, you know, at the beginning of the thing, I don't know how to kill Harold Crick is what she tells.
Right.
Escher. Yeah. Penny Escher. Yeah. So, I don't know how to kill Harold Crick, but that was pretty much, this is exactly what this book needs to be, you know, 'cause I put the bricks on the bricks on the bricks, and it's just like a structural engineer. Mm-hmm. This is how it has to be in order to hold up. And then, it takes a lot to get her to change that. 'Cause you know, she struggled with it even after she met Harold Crick. It wasn't an instantaneous, oh, this person's alive, therefore I'm not going to go through with this. You know,
no,
it took
she
her
agonizes.
Some time. Yeah.
Because
she agonizes
has
because
to
it's her building change. Or whatever. It's her structure.
Well, yeah, and it's a part of her. You know, anybody who's created anything knows that feeling. Mm-hmm. Well, and I was just kind of looking at these names just briefly, you know, from my own personal point of view. Penny's connection with M.C. Escher, you know, the artist who made all the impossible drawings that go in all kinds of directions that are kind of almost 3D. I was like, that actually works for what she does. She's putting together, she's making it possible for all kinds of odd connections to come together into one piece of art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
And, Harold's last name, he's named after Francis Crick.
Right.
Who with Watson and Wilkins found the structure of DNA. And if you go back to the Son of Man, DNA is the building block of life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For Christians, the Son of Man, that's it, man.
Mm-hmm.
He's it.
Yep, yep.
And then, you know, you just have, I didn't have a chance to look up all these people, but I do know that at the very end, the doctor who's saying, here's what happened to you.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned this.
Hit,
this is great, yeah.
He's Dr. Mercator, I think is how you say it.
Uh-huh.
But he's named after Gerardus Mercator, who was a 16th century Flemish cartographer. And what my husband got super excited about is he's the one who took the map and made it so it would go on a globe. So it's basically, you know, Iceland isn't gigantic because that's how it would look if the map's out of proportion. He goes, so basically life is in proportion then, or the, you know, map is in proportion.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's in perspective.
Right.
at that point. And so there are a lot of connections like that, that you just look at it and you go, these may have come later.
Yeah.
But even the bus line is named after Kronecker bus line.
Mm-hmm. I didn't notice that until you pointed it out.
Well, yeah. That's thank you, IMDb. a German-born mathematician and logician. And the thing that Hannah pointed out that I mentioned, but I'll say again, that's really hitting me right now is, you know, think of how many things happen when they're on the bus.
Yeah, yeah.
Harold meets Anna Pascal and is able to connect with her on a human level there. You mm-hmm. can't do that at her place.
Yeah.
You know, that's that road of life where you connect. He's reading the novel there.
Yeah, he read the whole book on the bus, right.
Just traveled on the bus the whole time and read it. You know, everybody's brought together by that little boy who's almost hit by the bus.
Yeah.
You know, the only person, well, I guess we don't see the authors and the literary people on there, but I was just like, for me, that kind of works. We're on this path.
Mm-hmm.
Who are we going to meet? We're getting on, we're getting off, we're doing different things, but eventually that bus is there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's kind of a randomness thing to it too. I think when he meets Anna Pascal on the bus,
mm-hmm.
and he says, are you a frequenter of the public transportation or whatever? And she says, no, I'm just late. But it just adds to the randomness of it all.
I mean, you know, we're kind of tearing it apart here because I've obviously been thinking about it a lot, but it's a great movie. It doesn't come at you as being heavy at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, if someone's listened through this, they've probably seen it and seen all the spoilers, I hope. But
yeah. It's a fantastic movie. You know, and yeah, you don't have to read deepness into it at all to enjoy it. Yeah, well, one other name that I wanted to mention that I thought was really cool was Mittag Leffler. Linda Hunt played a psychologist who was telling him that he needs to be on medication.
Yes, she was great.
Yeah, but it's just kind of cool. I looked that name up, and Mittag Leffler was a mathematician, and he was also a convinced advocate of women's rights. And was instrumental in making Sofia Kovalenskaya a full professor of mathematics in Stockholm. First woman anywhere in the world to hold that position. So it was just interesting.
Oh, that's great.
Really cool. That's
well, even Banneker Press, who is the publisher of Karen Eiffel's books, Benjamin Banneker was a free African-American mathematician, astronomer, clockmaker,
mm-hmm.
and publisher.
Yeah.
But something that was pointed out is also his friend who wants to go to space camp.
Oh, yes.
His name is Dave. And they said he's so connected with space. Well, think about 2001 Space Odyssey. It's not made clear, but everybody's like, well, how can you not think that it's probably.
Yes.
I love the little exchange they have. He's like, well, just imagine that you were told, like, what was the question? Like, you would have to die. You get to choose.
Yeah.
You know when you'll die or something. And he goes, well, do I have superpowers? What does that have to do with it? Well, I just want to know. Yeah.
Am I me? Am I me? Yes, you're you. You're you.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
You know, and he's like, well, okay, you have a superpower. And I can't remember what it was. And he's like, he's
invisible. Yeah.
Invisible. That's not a superpower. He goes, okay, you can do math in your head and it was.
Yeah, that's right. That's what he started with. He said, okay, you can do math problems. Really? That's not a superpower.
The other thing I noticed, though, is when Harold is much more himself, he's very directed, and I can't remember why, but, you know, he has a late movie visit back to the IRS to get something from his desk or look something up.
Mm-hmm.
And he's walking through the office and everybody, hi Harold, you're back from vacation, Harold, how was the time off, Harold? Everybody knows him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not even acknowledging most of them. But the thing I thought was, they may have done that earlier, you don't really notice it if they do. Certain people will always talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody was talking to him. And I just looked at that and went, he is so connected to all those people. You look at that as being a place that's very impersonal, but they all know who he is. And if he changes how he lives, how does that affect all those other people who know him?
Yeah, yeah.
In the way he's just interacting with them. That was just kind of my random thought on that. It's connected with people on a small level.
Again, it goes back to, you know, the kid on the bike and the lady driving the bus. And, you know, it's amazing how we do all affect each other.
And that you can't get away from that son of man thing. And I'm going to have to go look up the painting now, because even when Harold's late to the, or he's going to the bus, he's got the green apple in his mouth as he goes. He gets, grabs
right.
the green apple,
That's
puts
right.
it in his mouth.
He does.
I mean, in case we didn't get it before, here's a last reference, because the green apple rolls in front of the bus.
Amazing.
As he has willingly sacrificed himself.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And he's given a second chance. He comes back to life. Now, it's a regular human life, but his author tells the publisher he's got to make him live. He's got to let him live.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And I looked up the director. Because, you know, sometimes when I find a movie that I really like, you know, I feel like that film is really a director's medium, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you know,
yes.
So
they control, until you get to the editing process, they
exactly.
control it all.
Yeah. So, but he's done a really diverse list. His name is Mark Foster.
Okay.
Mark Forster, Forster.
Oh, okay.
And listen to this list of movies. Monsters Ball, Finding Neverland, and then Stranger Than Fiction, The Kite Runner, and Quantum of Solace, which is the James Bond movie. That's a lot. That's a diverse list of movies. You know, that's not the same thing twice.
He's one of those lucky ones then, because the way I understand it, you get boxed in and you have to really, now directors maybe not quite as much because look at, who's my other favorite one who I can't watch all his movies because of some he does. He did Millions and Traffic and I can't remember.
Traffic, I'm typing that in here.
Why can't I remember?
Traffic movie.
He's done so many really different
Steven
movies.
Steven Soderbergh?
Yeah.
It says he directed Traffic.
Millions. Then I got the wrong movie.
Okay. Millions.
Trainspotting. That's what I was thinking of.
Millions is directed by Danny Boyle.
That's it.
Okay.
Danny Boyle. He did Trainspotting. That was a movie about drugs.
I've seen Trainspotting.
And he did the one about the people going to the sun, the astronauts going to the sun to jumpstart it because the Earth is freezing.
And 28 Days Later, there's our zombie reference.
28 Days Later. Thank you. It had been way too long without zombies. Scott, you came through again.
Yes, you bet. Just trying to help.
And he did some other movie just recently that...
Let's see. His recent ones, it shows Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours.
Okay.
And then one called National Theater Live, which is some kind of a TV thing. Sunshine, Millions, 28
Sunshine
Days Later.
Yeah.
Vacuuming Completely
so
Nude in Paradise is a name of a TV movie.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like he just sees something he wants and he does it.
That's really cool. We were talking about Johnny Depp a little earlier, and I always felt Johnny Depp's career was like that, in that he was doing things that he wanted to do. You know, he could have been in, you know, like an action film star or something like that, but he didn't. You know, he didn't do that. And you know, I recommend Benny and June. Maybe we should watch that one time.
If it would work, it's on my list, and I've had so many people tell me that I need to see it. Yeah, he's kind of tied in, I think, in the national consciousness for us as Captain Jack Sparrow, but that's really not representative of his best stuff, I would
say. No, it isn't. You know, he must just absolutely love playing that character because, you know, he doesn't really do sequels, you know, and now he's on number 4.
Yeah,
so
I think he does. And it also could be what Krusty said. They drove a dump truck of money up to my house. a dump truck full of money. I couldn't say no.
Yeah, that's probably it.
But, and he does so many movies with Danny Elfman, that's who does music, Tim Burton.
Tim Burton, that's right. Yep.
He's part of his kind of favorite group, and he's always kind of eclectic too.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Well, great.
Well, there's probably more here, but I think we've probably pulled a lot out of it.
We have, and go see this movie if you haven't seen it.
Go get it.
Great show. Yeah.
Somewhere.
Definitely top 10 movie. You know.
I know. I wish Will Ferrell would do another movie like this.
Yes, me too.
Although I don't think it made much money, unfortunately.
Gosh, you know, so. I'm, you know, maybe not, but man.
I know. Yeah. Help it make money. Buy the DVD. It's probably cheap now. I know it's on my wish list at the top.
Yeah, for certain.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what's coming up next?
Let's see. On next, a we're good reading Mystery story. Of Grace.
It's hard to find. Oh, that's right.
Charles DeLint, I
great.
Think.
Great. I picked up the audiobook for The Mystery of Grace, so I think I'm going to listen to the audiobook.
Who reads it?
That's what I was excited about. Ty Simmons is one of the readers. There's actually two.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So, in fact, let me grab it here.
I want it so much now. Thank you for adding something else to my covetousness.
You bet. Paul Michael Garcia and Ty Simmons. Now, Ty Simmons is exciting because she read The Reapers Are the Angels, and she read it so well.
I know. I'll be curious to hear you talking about The Mystery of Grace, because that's a Hispanic character.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
In the Southwest.
Yeah, I'm wondering how they're going to split this up. Like I said, two narrators. So.
Well, it's told from two different points of view.
Okay.
It's a man and a woman's point of view, woman is predominant.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, this is an interesting one, which I guess we'll talk about next time, but I really almost never buy books that I haven't gotten from the library first or as a review copy, because I just don't have the money to go around doing that. But between Christmas and New Year's, I gave myself permission to go into Borders and just buy, like $50 worth of books.
Mm-hmm.
And with a title like Mystery of Grace, I jumped right off the science fiction shelf into my hands.
Right, right. Cool.
And, so I'll be curious to see how you like it.
Yeah. This one came in as a review copy for SFF Audio. And it got donated to the library a while back.
Okay.
And so I went and checked it out.
Dang. Well, if it's a review copy, maybe I can have a copy of it.
Of course you can. Yep.
So
you bet. And then after that, what have we got?
Oh, let's see. Then it's your choices.
Oh, my gosh. We're back on there.
Which I've never even heard of.
Oh, yeah. Fallen. Yeah. Fallen, the 1998. This is a Denzel Washington movie.
Yeah. Angels and Demons kind of
stuff. Yeah, it's kind of got angels and demons and stuff in it. I don't, I know that it's not like orthodox.
That's not what we're about here.
Yeah.
We personally are. That's
exactly
the point.
Exactly.
But we like everything. That's the point.
You bet. You bet. Good movie. I really enjoy that movie. Fallen, and make sure that it's Fallen with Denzel Washington. There's an angel show out there called Fallen, and that's not it. That's why I put 1998 on it.
Yeah, I saw it.
And then the book is on May 25th. We'll do Stories of Your Life and Others by probably my favorite science fiction author that's currently at work today. His name is Ted Chiang.
He's good. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So. I love his short stories.
Mm-hmm. And that's his collection.
Yeah.
Which has almost everything he's written. It had everything he's written to the date that it was published, but it was published maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And he's done some things since. So
it's my excuse to buy it, because I've heard two or three of his stories narrated, like on Starship Sofa and places like that. And they just always blew me away. So I want Hannah to read them. And here's the thing I have to say about Kindle versus regular books.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem reading things on the Kindle, especially if I'm not sure if I'm going to read them again. Although I just tend to not spend money on them that way, because if you haven't picked it up, I got no money and I'm cheap too. So, but if I read something like that and I want Hannah to read it, I have to buy the regular book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she'll go through the shelves and pick up stuff and Rose too when she's home.
Yeah,
that I wouldn't have expected. So
sure, okay.
This is my excuse to get them to one of them to read them.
Well, good.
Yeah,
that'd be great. They're terrific stories. Looking forward to talking about them.
Yeah, so I guess the next time we meet, it will be the first week of Easter.
It will. Yes. Yes.
Has it been a good Lent for you?
It has. It's been generally really, really good. Yeah, I participated more fully than I have in the past. I kind of go again in waves.
Yeah, well,
and
don't we all?
Yeah, and it's been really good. It's been really good experience.
Yeah.
How about yourself?
Really good. And for anybody who's still listening who's not Catholic or Christian, a really good Lent means spiritual growth or insights or more connection with God. And because this is a concentrated time, of course, that's you don't have that as your set goal, but that's what you're hoping for. And it's funny, because last year, man, it was all through personal sacrifice and struggle with a couple of individuals that I had to just, learn to let things go more and take it on the chin and things like that. And so that was really obvious. And I suddenly realized that this time, it's been all through my reading. I read The Story of a Soul for a book club I'm in, a Catholic women's book club, and that was much more enlightening than I thought, and I really got, you know, St. Therese isn't what you'd call, you know, my best buddy or anything, but I've got a real connection to her that I didn't have before. And then I listened to The Hiding Place, which I, you know, have talked about everywhere because I'm so into it right now. But ChristianAudio.com has a free download
For
the month of April, and it is an excellent narration. I had forgotten how fully inspirational it is. I have a review that's going to be up on Pathios.com tomorrow. If anybody's interested, I'll try and remember to put the link here so I don't take all our time and bore everybody about it. But I was amazed at how many simple lessons about trusting God I have been applying to my own life thanks to that book. And that's the reason she wrote it.
Yeah, so, great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So. Yeah, I haven't successfully really got through everything I wanted to get through in Lent. I wanted to finish Jesus of Nazareth by Pope Benedict.
Heavy duty, man.
Yeah, heavy duty. I'm slowly working my way through that. I'm a little farther than it says on Goodreads, but I don't update that all the time.
Yeah.
And then I'm still going through that course on Catholic Church history, which I've heard before, but I'm going through it in a more meticulous way. And that was something else I wanted to complete in Lent. And I'm not going to get quite finished with it, but it's been fruitful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, I'm listening to less podcast type, episode type things, and more books.
Yeah.
Because I listened to, I've been listening also to the Chronicles of Narnia. And did I mention those last time? They're narrated by, there was a free download from this good narrator that was available. And I think Jesse on SFF had linked to it and somebody else. And I'd seen it around. So I tried it and I was like, oh, well, she's good, but so I went to the library and they had the full 7-book set, and it was done a few years ago, but Michael York narrates The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Lynn Redgrave narrates Prince Caspian. I mean, every single one has a star actor. I mean, The Last Battle, I've only gotten through 2 of the books. I'm alternating them with other reading, but the last one's narrated by Patrick Stewart.
Oh, wow. How cool is that?
Yeah, and I've never really cared for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe because it was pushed on me when I was in my 20s, so I was too old for it. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't Christian, so I was like, okay, fine. But I can appreciate them now just as fabulous children's stories, and then also they have their inspirational message that I appreciate in the other books more than the first one. So
Great. Yeah. Yeah, I was just here looking for there's this quote that I absolutely love from the Chronicles of Narnia. Uh-huh. And I have it on my Goodreads, but I can't figure out how to... Oh, there we go. Quotes. Click.
You have to go to your homepage.
There we go.
I
found it. Okay. Let's see.
Because I've been looking for those too.
Let's see. Yeah. Yeah, I thought I put it in here. Oh, there it is. Yep. This is from The Silver Chair.
Okay.
I daren't come and drink, said Jill. Then you will die of thirst, said the lion. Oh dear, said Jill, coming another step nearer. I suppose I must go and look for another stream then. There is no other stream, said the lion.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's from The Silver Chair.
Yeah. That is good.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one I liked was, and I think I have it in mind, but it essentially is from, because I've only listened to the first 2, and now I need to start, I guess, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, because I'm listening in publication order. And Lucy is talking to the lion, and she hadn't gone ahead and done something the lion wanted her to because everybody else said it was stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, well, but they wouldn't come with me. I couldn't get them to come. And she's like, oh, wait, you think I should have just done it anyway? And she says, well, what good would that have done? And he's like, well, there's no way of telling.
Mm-hmm.
You can't tell. And she says, so you mean good would have come of it anyway? And he goes, well, there's only one way to find out if good will come of something, and you have to basically step out and do it, even if you're afraid or everything. And I was like, yep, good point.
Yep.
And they're just well-told children's stories, too.
Yeah, and I haven't read those since I was a kid, you know, when I wasn't catching those kinds of things. So it'd be well worth rereading.
Plus, C.S. Lewis told children's stories in such an engaging way. He'll say, well, it's not this kind of thing, like we would hate. Uh-huh. And you're right, yes, I would hate that. It's this kind of thing that we would love. Oh, I would love that. You know, it's that old-fashioned way. And I've appreciated him more as as a writer, I used to think, oh, what a hack. I mean, I hate to say that about mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis, because I knew about the Narnia things.
Mm-hmm.
But the Screwtape Letters is wonderful.
Yeah.
It's that kind of a thing for adults, really. And then I read Till We Have Faces, which is one of the most science fictionish, mind-blowing retellings of the story of Psyche and Cupid that you will ever lay eyes on. We're going to have to do it, but it's amazing. And mm-hmm. at the end, I wasn't even sure I knew what I thought or what it meant. It's so deep. And then I'd love to read the Paralandra things.
Oh,
because
yes.
now, mm-hmm. yeah, because now I'm thinking he changes styles. He just slips around in style so easily. I can't even imagine what those would be like.
Yeah, for certain.
Have you read them?
I read the first one. Okay. What was that one called?
You might not have liked it, or
no, I just don't recall continuing. You know, I seem to do that a lot. I'll read the first of a series and don't continue.
Doesn't hit you.
You know, it's just not, you know, but I don't remember disliking it, but I can't remember what the first one's called.
Yeah.
But well, it wasn't Paralandra. Paralandra is number two, I think.
No, it's, there's a variety of names and I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Paralandra trilogy, really.
Mm-hmm.
But then he also wrote so many really good nonfiction books.
Yeah, and those I've read a few. I've got a really nice copy of the Screwtape Letters read by John Cleese.
Yes.
It's fun.
And Tom had got me that from Audible, and he can't get into his Audible account anymore.
Oh, no.
So I can't get to it anymore.
We must crack into that account.
Yes, yeah. He's got to figure out a way to do it, because I'd like him to listen. Mm-hmm. He doesn't ever listen to this kind of book or read it or anything. So.
Right.
Anyhow.
All right.
Oh, well, we've run really
yes,
long.
Yes, we've run.
Sorry.
No. Good heavens. This has been fun, as always. So
yes.
We'll see. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And yeah, sorry. Sorry it went so long, but yeah. Obviously we love sharing.
You bet.
So
we'll see you in a couple weeks. Yep.
Have a great Holy Week and a wonderful Easter.
Yes, you too.
Okay.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.